Hook, ain't got you in a murder town.
About a change of model of development. And the common denominator of this suggestion to change the world is the persistent way in which the proponents escape from the fundamental problem of the appropriation of fruits of technological progress and the distribution of income. For me, there is no possibility of changing the model of development if there is no substantial change in the process of appropriation of the fruits of technological progress, the process of accumulation and distribution of income. In other terms, generally, they turn away from the phenomenon, turn away their eyes from the phenomenon of the surplus and capital accumulation. And in my view, a change of model requires an acceleration of capital accumulation, both in material goods and in education and in health and other things. I think that we have to broaden the concept of investment. Why I'm saying so? Because the belief supported by conventional theories that the fruits of the increasing productivity through technological progress will be socially diffused has not been observed in real facts. I think that the theory that supports this view is utterly mistaken, judging from the Latin American point of view. I do not like at this moment to trespass, to enter into the phenomena of the centers, because it is enough for me to fight in a Latin American front and not to add the center front. It's why it is misleading. I try to explain in a series of articles and in a book that is becoming a little old-fashioned now, after 5 years, I try to prove that even in the most absolutely plain or free of market forces, the increases in productivity are appropriated by the high income groups that have the greater part of the means of production and those social groups that have the qualifications that should accompany the penetration of modern technology. That is to say, in one case, that own the means of production, in the other case, that due to social factors are the best qualified people to participate into the fruits of increasing productivity. There is no tendency during the functioning of the laws of the market to extend the fruits of productivity to those ample social groups that do not have the power to share on these fruits. Why? I will make a description very superficial of how I see the phenomena happening when there is a continuous superposition of technological layers in the process of development. A new layer of higher productivity than the existing layers increases the demand for labor in this new layer of productivity, and the wages and salaries, except of those people qualified to accompany this technological development, the wages do not increase correlatively to the increase in productivity. Why it is so? Because there are large masses of the population working with lower productivity and in the extreme with very low productivity and very low income. And they compete with the labor force that is absorbed with higher productivity. They compete with this labor force and are a negative factor against a correlative increase in wages and salaries. It's the competition from below that tends, during the free play of market forces, tend to deprive of those that are working with high productivity, deprive them of the participation in these fruits of high productivity. I don't know if it is clear. It's a phenomenon of a structural character. The heterogeneity of the social structure is behind this original distribution of income. I underline the expression the free trade of market forces, because oligopoly or monopoly accentuates this phenomenon. But we may conceive of a society where there is no such oligopoly, in which the fruits of technological progress do not trickle down to all the social groups. The conventional theory expects that. Expect this social diffusion through the decrease in prices, There is no such thing. Prices do not decrease according to the increase in productivity. What is the surplus? I define the surplus as that part of the increase in productivity that is not transferred to the labor force absorbed by this new layer of productivity. This problem is very clear when there are great differences in productivity in this heterogeneous social structure. But even if the layers of very low productivity disappear, whenever, as it is the real case, there are differences in productivity due to the fact that new technologies in the periphery do not cover suddenly all the social structure, but only a part of it, this problem presents itself even if those that have been lagging behind are now working with better productivity, provided that this productivity and income is lower than the new layers of increasing productivity. This is why I consider the surplus as a fundamentally structural problem at this stage of the evolution of society in the at the periphery as a structural phenomenon. That means, again, the surplus is that part of the increase in productivity that is not transferred to the whole labor force. The part that is not transferred is added to the existing surplus and increases the surplus. Yes, please.
With this definition, if prices go down, do you include this in the economic surplus, which is then that is an economic surplus transferred to the consumers of the goods, or is economic surplus the only the part which remains for the producer when he has paid wage?
Well, good question. I will answer now in immediately. What is the dynamic role of the surplus? It's very important because the main source of capital accumulation is the surplus. But at the same time, the surplus is the source of the privileged consumption society, of the high income strata that are favored by the surplus. So the surplus is divided into two: capital accumulation and consumption. It so happened that in Latin America we are subject to the sheer imitation of the forms, the patterns of consumption of the center. So that there is a continuous pressure to use a sizable part of the surplus for consumption rather than capital accumulation. Contrary, say, to the historical development of some centers and the case of Japan, where the surplus in an austere society is accumulated. Our capitalism is far from being austere. This is why, in parentheses, when the gentleman of yesterday was mentioning the transfer of the economic surplus from the periphery to the center as a reason why there was underdevelopment, I said to him, do not forget that the transfer is really minor in relation to the wastage of the surplus in the privileged consumption society in Latin America. We could have had a much higher rate of growth if this society would have been an austere society, and far from it. All right. The dynamic role of the surplus is very important. The surplus and the high income derived from the increases in productivity, those that are fortunate enough to be able to participate into the fruits of development. The dynamic role is very important because for the system to grow continuously, it is essential the growth of the surplus. That is to say, it is continue, it is necessary the growth of the surplus on the basis of social inequality. The dynamic of the system is based on social inequality. And if we try to modify the distribution of income following this criteria of equity without transforming the process of appropriation, we encroach into the growth of the system, and the system fails. I have made an elaborate demonstration of this in a recent article that I was mentioning to Professor Carlson, the last number of the Revista de la Cepal. I would not take your time in showing this, in describing the process. Maybe a short explanation will give an insight of how the actual appropriation happens. Kaki was rightly saying yesterday that the Marxist surplus value has not the full explanation of the process of appropriation, because for the surplus to be appropriated, he rightly said yesterday, it is necessary an increase in demand. Where is the increase of demand by which the surplus, the increase in productivity, is appropriated? I think that we have to answer this question. And in my view, and I will sacrifice the explanation for not overload you and for reasons of time, in my view, we have to see how the productive process evolves from raw materials to the final product. In a growing economy, in a dynamic model, as is the case in real fact, what enterprises paid to the labor force to produce a growing amount of final goods in the course of time is the clue to the increase in demand that Kaki was looking for. Let me explain that. There is a time element between the production of raw materials, the labor used there, and the wages paid, and the final goods, the period of time. The demand for the final goods do not emerge from the income paid to those that have produced the final goods in all the stages, but from the income paid in the process of production of final goods that will emerge in the course of time. So that the sale laws, demand, supply, creates his own demand, is not only mistaken, as Keynes showed and other writers, but is mistaken because maybe right in a static society. That's not the case. But in a dynamic process of growth, it is the increase of income paid for getting final goods in the course of time that constitutes the demand for final goods entering now into the market. And it is due to this that the increase in productivity embodied in these final goods is gotten, is appropriated by the enterprises. Finally, by the owners of means of production and those qualified people that have all the technical qualifications to use the new layers of technology. So that it is a structural factor combined with the time element in the process of production. If the process of production were instantaneous, if there was no time between raw materials and final product, then the process will be quite different. But it is the time element, and I will add other elements that I will not use now to not to complicate. The income paid in the production, in production in process, is not all used in goods, it's used in services, it circulates in services. That's another one. Very important from the cyclical point of view. But let us not complicate our minds with this. To put it shortly now, and this is a challenge to those able to use mathematics, not for not thinking, but for thinking better. Very frequent case, at least in my part of the world. They indulge in large formulas that they cannot explain why it is so. There are two very important variables. The increment of income emerging from the production in process, the growth of production in order to arrive to the final goods. There is the increment of income paid by enterprises in the course of production of future goods, and the increment in productivity in final goods emerging now in the market, in the same period. There is a close relationship. Increment of income, increment of productivity. It is this increment of income that absorbs the increment of productivity without the fall of prices. This is my explanation why in the historical development of capitalism, except long waves of high prices, growing, ascending and descending prices, are minor in relation to the increments of productivity. This is why the fruits of increasing productivity of the system have not been transferred, have not been diffused in the community. In the free play of forces of the market. What is the role of monetary policy? What was the role? What was, I underline, the role in monetary policy in other stages of structural changes? To assure a proper relationship between the income of the man and the income of productivity. If the creation of money would tend to surpass the increment of productivity, prices go up. And the monetary authority, if they have the determination to have a stable money, will restrict credit and provoke the reaction of the system. This was the conventional wisdom of monetary authorities in the past. And I may say that due to my long existence, I as a central banker had to practice that. I would not do the same now. Why? Because this was 50 years ago. Now there are two very important factors interfering with the efficiency of monetary policy that oblige us to look for other solutions. Is the increasing force, increasing power of the labor force, both union power and political power. Political power through the state and the growth of the state. That is a general phenomenon, exaggerated in many cases, especially in Latin America, but it's the increasing role of the state. Then what happens? The system functions relatively well when the monetary authority can keep the control in such a way that prices do not increase beyond, that prices do not increase. But when the union power gets increases in salary higher than the increases in productivity, higher than the increases in productivity, and the monetary authority creates an increment of money that allows for an increment of demand, this equality between increment of income and increment of productivity is broken, and prices go up. However, the monetary authority is not happy with this and tries to use the old weapon of restricting credit. And what is the result? If they restrict credit and the power, the union power and political power is strong enough, what happens? Less credit means less employment. Higher salaries and less employment. There is a trade-off for them. If credit for the circulating capital, the working capital connected with the formation of with product, the course of production in process, when credit is not available for increasing employment and at the same time the wages beyond productivity, enterprises are forced to use the available credit to pay for higher salaries and less employment. This is the mystery of stagflation that did not exist before. It's the breaking of this relationship. I would not accuse the labor force of abusing from the system for the following reason. That there is a surplus there, and that is the source of sheer inequality. If they push the increase in wages, one can imagine a system where this encroachment on the surplus would be to the detriment of consumption of the high-income groups, the consumption of those having in their hands the means of production. But that's not so. Part probably is to the detriment of consumption, but part is to the detriment of investment. And the decrease in the rate of investment means a decrease of in the rate of employment and further capital accumulation. So that in the present system there is no solution for the problem when these new factors, growth of the state and great power of the labor union, exists. There was a solution before, but not now. Because to restrict credit, there is an alternative. Either monetary authorities restrict credit and bring unemployment sooner or later breaks the force, the union force, making for lower wages or for interfering with the process of pushing wages up. That's all right. This is a good remedy at a high social cost, an economic cost, reduction of production, reduction in employment, and finally, weakening of the union power. But sooner or later, they have to abandon credit restriction due to this, to the pressure both of enterprises and the labor force. And again, the monetary authorities have to increase credit and increase employment and increase production and use better the existing capacity. And then the unions get new power to try to push wages and to capture part of the surplus. But this means that, again, this equality between the increase in income and increase in productivity is broken. Increases of wages beyond productivity means a disequilibrium conducive to the increase in prices. So that the system, in my view, as it functions, has no way out. Far from being a wise allocation of resources, the system can operate with periodic destruction of resources. That is to say, labor force that is unemployment and a potential for capital accumulation that is lost, and existing capacity of industries is not used properly. And if this were a final remedy, all right, let us suffer the consequence for once. But again, the process is repeated. this is the case, the typical cases in some of the Latin American countries. That does not mean to say that always it is the push of wages that starts an inflationary process. The inflationary process may come from the budget deficit. That is to say, even if wages are moderate and they do not over trespass the equality income increment of income increment of productivity, if the government, the fiscal deficit is responsible for the creation of additional money, then the equality between income and demand on one side and increasing productivity on the other side is broken also. But in this case, the increase in demand does not pertain to the labor force, but comes from the budget deficit. And the two factors interact. In general, the budget deficit is not a mere fiscal accident. It is a consequence of this continuous struggle to share in the fruits of growing productivity. This is why I consider that to speak about a new model of growth of Latin America, as we have to do, and overlook what I have explained to you in a very superficial way, is nonsensical. But whenever I, in discussions in Latin America, I touch upon this problem, I thought that's too complicated, this idea of the surplus is too complicated. Or is Marxism, or Marxists say, no, this is not the explanation. The explanation is the explanation of Marx. I'm happy that the Marxists recognize, as Kaki, the author, that Marx sometimes is mistaken, sometimes. I am disturbing mentally this boy. How to deal with the problem? Many times they put this question to me and I remind story, an episode in Hyde Park some 60 years ago in London. I used to go to Hyde Park to see the discussions of political leaders. And there was an old man who was explaining Marx. He made a beautiful explanation of the labor theory of value and the crisis of capitalism. And a young man there said, well, old man, what do you propose? He said, I have not read yet the second volume. Well, this may be an answer of mine today, not to enter in other aspects, but I think that we have to deal with the way of a rational distribution of the surplus. I use with care the expression rational because in the system there is no rationality. The establishment of a proper relationship between the growth of the surplus, the rate of capital accumulation, the rate of increase in the expenditures of the state, the rate of increases of the wages and salaries. That means a macroeconomic regulation of the currents of income and capital accumulation. Macro. What's macro regulation? Is something new? But the use of the modern monetary weapon is a macro regulation of the creation of money. That does not interfere with personal initiative. When Mr. Volcker is decreasing, restricting credit, he is macro regulating for good or evil the economy of the United States without interfering in the behavior of enterprises. This is macro regulation. But I maintain the view that macro regulation of the monetary sphere is not enough. If you do not regulate it in a macroeconomic way, the currents of income and the distribution between consumption and accumulation, you are bound to run from crisis to crisis. And here again is what we should try to see. Through, I was speaking about the social use of the surplus 5 years ago, but people get so excited against me that I prefer now to use the expression an adequate incomes policy with a proper regulation of macroeconomic capital accumulation. This is why, Professor Carlson, I was so interested in the modest Swedish idea of giving the workers a participation in capital accumulation. And I think that the theory behind, as it was explained to me last year, was very sound. They recognized that pushing wages beyond a certain point would interfere with the regular process of capital accumulation. But as according to what this gentleman of last year told me, this was detrimental to the rate of capital accumulation, to the increase in productivity, to the competitiveness of Sweden in world markets. So that was a very convincing element. I say, all right, let us take part of the participation of labor to accumulate. Beautiful for all except for the enterprises. Who hangs the bell into the cat? I said yes. It seems that the cat is not amenable to that type of manipulation. Well, this is, in my view, this is the greatest problem of peripheral capitalism. You may ask me if that's a problem of the center. I am inclined to believe also. But I do not fight on two fronts. Thank you. Well, young man, you are responsible for deviating me from integration. Would you share in this explanation about model of development? Or you have another idea?
I don't know, I don't have an idea. But I was also thinking one thing is the theoretical frame of work or this aspect, or even the strategic aspect of the model, if we can call it. countries in Latin America. And if you incorporate all this thinking, for instance, the political and social aspect today, well, problems like the external debt, the position and the power of the different social and political sectors in our country. I really wonder if your ideas are positive today.
Are
possible for resolving the present day problem. Because, of course, in order to solve economical problems, we can think a theory, policy, and we need time, an economic time for doing it. But during this economic time, there are other more urgent problems to solve, very linked with political and social aspects. So that's the point, or that's one of the points of my debate today. What do you think about it?
Well, I may say in answering you that this theory or attempt to explain theoretically the surplus means the recognition that you cannot explain the actual process of distribution in our countries through an economic theory. A theory has to embrace not only economic and technological factors, but social, cultural, and political factors. You cannot explain the appropriation of the fruits of technological progress or the process of distribution in the light of an economic theory. You have to consider the structure of society, the changes in the structure of society, and the political, the social and political developments that accompany this change in the structure of society. Without that, you cannot explain the appropriation of the fruits of technological development, neither the process of redistribution that results from the structure changes in society. That is to say, from the labor union force, both directly or through the political process, neither the cultural changes accompanying the changes in the structure of society, neither the use, the selection of technologies that are influenced by the distribution of income. So that I have mentioned only part of a very complex process. Now, to mention the political factor. It is necessary for those progressive parties, progressive parties, to change their way of trying to increase the level of living of the masses. And this is the great mistake of advanced parties in Latin America, as in other parts of the world, to think that they can improve persistently the welfare of the masses of the population through increases in wages and salaries beyond the increase in productivity. That means inflation. This is what I am saying to people in Argentina. They say, you are reactionary. You write with one hand in CEPAL, and when advising the government, you say different things. I say, no. I'm equally interested than you in the improvement of the welfare. But for years what has been done for more than 50 years in Latin America. More than 50 years. Do not repeat this policy. And they said, no, we will not accept any policy that whose evil consequences fall on the shoulders of the masses. We do not accept that the variable of adjustment is the salary of the population. I said, neither I. But what you are doing is precisely what has been done during so many years. A policy that finally is detrimental, falls into the wage barriers, the variable of wages, the wage barriers. Not only due to this policy, but to a combination of very mistaken policy, especially in the last 10 years. With the result that per capita income in Argentina now is lower than in 1970. Then to improve some social groups is to the detriment of others. Yes, insofar as you can transfer income from the others. This is why I say, all right, let us not readjust salaries according to the cost of living, because this accelerates inflation, but let us do that at the expense of the profits of the enterprise. One thing is to increase salaries and costs and prices, and one is to take part of the profit to compensate for the increment of salaries. This is the way of idea that I think that should be considered. They said, well, if profits are insufficient, then we have to reactivate the economy simultaneously with the decrease in the rate of inflation. That's a very complete. But I am against continuing a wrong policy. Please, Professor.
You have been stressing the necessity for a new model of growth in Latin America and a more rational use and distribution of surplus. Could you kind of comment a little bit about Cuba, but try to at least to implement a new model of growth, of course, and all the difficulties they had in implementing that model, since I know that you have visited the island many times?
Well, the Cubans, in order to use in a rational way the surplus, have socialized the economy. That brings another problem, very, very difficult to solve. I once talked with Cubans, high-level Cubans, not Fidel, about the management of enterprises. If they were trying to introduce elements of self-management, as in the Soviet Union, Andropov tried to do that, but it so happens that the weight of the past, even in socialist countries, are perhaps more than in others, is too heavy. It reminds me of John the Fourth, the Pope. Who was the Pope that tried to modernize the church, Riaggiornamento? John 23rd. He tried to modernize the church, aggiornamento, as he says. But the Roman Curia was a brick, put a brick on him. And I'm afraid that the Curia in the socialist country, the light Curia, the Curia of high officials of the system of the bureaucracy, is against change. There is a very enlightened element that tried to give more freedom to the enterprises and use the market. Not abandon the macro regulation of the economy, but for a better regulation. But this has obstacles. And I'm afraid that the Cubans have fallen into that too. Notwithstanding their desire, the desire of some enlightened element of the system, to change. Because they are afraid of the consequences of low productivity as in the Soviet Union. I have a great interest in following the Hungarian model. Not because it is perfect, far, far from it, but because they have initiated a new rule for having the advantage of increasing productivity and freedom inside a market, not in everything, because they have a control, planning, combination of the market with planning. And I hope that this will be the outcome of Cuba. I don't know when and how. But there are people who are thinking in this term, as you probably know. Please.
According to your analysis, the system, the system of Latin America now functions in such a way that if someone tries to decrease the surplus of the privileged groups, they either have the political power and the control of central banks and so on, that through inflation they keep their share, or that if they are not managed this way, there will be an economic crisis and less investment and less employment, unemployment, and there will be a periodic crisis. So in the actual system, the people who get this economic surplus, they have the power in one way or the other to keep this share. So now you propose a new way of using this. And this means you must break with these mechanisms, that you must either you must be able to control a share of the economic surplus which these leading groups are now controlling without getting an economic crisis, without if we take Jamaica as an example, where Manley, as a, I know quite little about the Jamaican case, but as you see, he tried to use the surplus in a new way, a more social way, perhaps not so much for accumulation, I don't know. But what the...
Not so much for accumulation. That's very important.
The reaction of the private sector, private capitalists, and also international capital, was to flee the country and not to invest there any longer. And they ran into a deep crisis. They had to go to the International Monetary Fund, and the International Monetary Fund said, "You must do this and that." And that meant you must use the economic surplus in the way you always have done. Mm. So this experiment of Manley was destroyed. I mean, I have tried to see who in Latin America has tried to go in the direction you are.
Nobody.
And now we have Castro has used the surplus in one way, but
no.
their freedom was, you say, destroyed. But in Jamaica, where they tried to use the more rational way, there was a contact group. It also restricted the freedom in another way. And they were back in the old model. So what are the choices that if you have, do you have to choose between Jamaica or Cuba, or is there even further some possibility?
No, if you give me the option between the two, I would say Cuba. On the other hand, I consider Castro a political genius, without exaggeration. He has managed in a very difficult situation to push the economy of Cuba with great problems. I don't know if Manley is such a person, but there is a difference between the two. In addition to that, Cuba had great resources from the Soviet Union that have been of considerable help to him. What I think is that when the left arrives to power in Latin America, they do what they should not do. Not only in the case of Latin America. Let us take the case of Mitterrand. When he arrived to power, a socialist young man wrote an article in Le Monde warning his party. He said, be careful in trying to improve the situation of the masses through massive increases in salaries. That's not the way. We lost the power that we got under Blum before the war. We lost the power after the war when socialism was now we have gained election, be careful, not do the same. And they did. And they had to retreat. And to look in one way or another the support of the right. And the support of the right is not a free good. Well, it is a tragedy. It is a tragedy. This is why I think that we have to look for new ways to go directly to the surplus. You are right in saying to go directly to the surplus would hurt the state interest. I am not a political genius to find a way. And when Castro took power, there was no way of dealing with the problem. So that he may do that, gradually through self-management and then getting the surplus of enterprises and macroeconomic regulating the distribution of the surplus. He has a good historical opportunity. There are no vested interests except the bureaucracy, and this is very important.
May I just continue on this in this field, because I think it's very important and it's interesting. Because when we have a Cuban case, then we could say is that they have had some progress in many fields, but also many drawbacks, as you say, bureaucracy and perhaps political dependence on the Soviet Union and so on. And then we have a Jamaican case, and we know what happened to that. And then now we have Nicaragua, we haven't mentioned. They also try, I mean, it's a very small country, but try to industrialize. And probably they would be 100% they would agree with you on your analysis here, the need for a new type of model of growth. You know, as a matter of fact, I was in Nicaragua, so I know it by our discussion along this time, these lines. But then the problem is going from theory to practice, because they now are in power. So what would be your advice to them? They want to industrialize, how should I do it? You know, not repeat the errors of Cuba and having this type of model that you are speaking about.
You are referring to Nicaragua?
Yes.
Unfortunately, I have not visited Nicaragua. But perhaps they had too much enthusiasm of a new movement, in which they had a magnificent success by defeating Somoza. And they had to fight on two fronts, the internal front of business and the pressure of the United States, that unfortunately, as things prove, is against any kind of experiment that means socialism. This is why they oppose Allende from the beginning, because this was socialism that may put in fire the whole of Latin America. Nonsense. And they finally succeeded in what they wish. And this is what they are doing in Nicaragua, even at the cost of a military intervention to eradicate socialism, with counterproductive results. I was invited to the Kissinger Commission, and I started with a short story, history, that I have seen. I said, I will not tell you about things that I have read, but I think things about which I have seen, which I saw in my life. Arbenz, by the middle 50s, had a moderate program of land reform that hurt the interest of the United Fruit Company. That was the name of the American company, as well as the interest of the big landowners that have the monopoly of the land in Guatemala. The State Department, in combination with this interest, organized the invasion from other Central American countries. The invasion was successful and avoided land reform in Guatemala. That would have been a wise operation to diminish the social pressure of the large Indian masses without land. Well, they considered that this was a very successful operation. And what happens now in Guatemala is a result of that. In Salvador, the supported the few families, 14 or 18, owning the land and in industry. They opposed any government that may change this state of things. And they supported the army fighting against reform, even a moderate reform as the reform that was trying to apply the present, the new president, Napoleon Duarte. They led the army to interfere with the political process. And in Nicaragua, we all know that. It's the lack of foresight, the lack of a clear philosophy of what Latin America, to understand and to help Latin America in the changes that are necessary. This was the attraction that Kennedy exercised to all of us. The recognition that the United States, instead of opposing changes, should help countries to introduce changes. One of the items of the gospel of Kennedy was land reform, as well as other reforms. Unfortunately, he died, and even if he had lived, he would have had the tremendous resistance of the conservative elements in Latin America. But even so, he supported Frei. Whatever you think of Frei, what he did with Allende later on, we have to recognize that for the 60s he was an enlightened man. He was a man sincerely trying to improve the situation of the masses and to do a good land reform. But Kennedy had disappeared. There was another man at the helm. Another man at the helm and another Secretary of State. That at that time, as he confessed, he was not interested in Latin America, but in East-West. And they followed a tremendously mistaken policy. So is the world in which we live.
By this, I think we have to end the discussions for today. We thank Mr. Priebisch, and we are lucky to have him with us tomorrow, too.
I would say to interrupt the discussion, because there are many things to discuss.